Blog Talk Radio.
Canto in Dallas, Texas on Friday, February the 16th. Today we're going to be chatting with our good friend Barry Jacobson. What am I saying? Barry Jacobson, our good friend, the military historian, a great friend of our show. And I know his name is Barry. How can I make such a stupid mistake? So I hope he forgives me for that. But we're going to be talking about some interesting developments in the Middle East, the Russians in Syria. You have Israeli air strikes on Syria, as well as Iranian positions. That's very interesting. ISIS and Hamas fighting in the Sinai. So this is very interesting stuff, very serious stuff. And obviously, we want to get a good understanding of it. And that's why we're checking with our friend Barry today. We're also going to look a little bit at some of the current events. There's a lot of things going on. The gun control debate, again, is going on. I find this to be fascinating. Somebody came up with the idea that this young man, Cruz, in Florida was a white supremacist, and they ran with that. Turned out to be he's not. At least he's not a member of any group, white supremacist group. So it's just amazing to me, how much misinformation is out there about gun control, about what happened down there, the different, even the words that we use to describe guns are completely confusing. So it's very difficult, and I appreciate if any of you are confused, because I am. Let me say hello to our good friend Barry. I hope you'll forgive me for the rest of your life, because I said Brian. You know, maybe I was thinking of Brian Wilson. That's it. Maybe I was thinking of Brian Wilson.
Yeah, I'll go by Brian, I guess. I guess as good his name as any.
Well, no, I don't know how
Barry
that happened.
Jacobson.
Yeah, I mean, I've got your name written in big letters here on my agenda in front of me on my tablet. You know, all the information there. I don't know what happened.
Well, for your listening audience who's new to the show, we and I have been friends for what, 7 years now, 5 years, something like
least,
that.
Yeah,
so.
Okay. That's right. So
pretty sure
I think
you know
one. I think so, and I think one mistake every 7 years is probably okay.
That's right.
So, I mean, if you ever mistake me, yeah, I mean, every 7 years, I think you can screw up something with a friend. We're going to get into a lot of very good, very important stuff happening in the Middle East, but I thought maybe today we'd touch on a couple of things, a couple of big stories of the moment. I'm sure you've got some opinions on this, but The chief, not the chief justice, but the independent counsel, Mr. Mueller, indicted 13 Russians today. And I have not seen a lot of the coverage on television about this. I did follow a little bit on the radio. But, you know, it's interesting. This is all he has after all this time. And, you know, the assistant attorney general made it very clear today. I did catch a bit of his press conference when he said there were no Americans involved in this. Willingly involved, I guess. I mean, I don't know what's next, but so far there's not really much here, Barry.
Doesn't seem to be. You know, we can all hold our breath and wait, but and I'm sure there's more coming. I doubt this is going to be the final round of indictments, but so far it is much ado about nothing. There have been some people who are associated with the Trump campaign that have been indicted, but none of them were indicted or pled guilty, if not indicted, at least pled guilty, to charges related to Russian collusion. And several of them, did, like Manafort, for instance, his malfeasance was done before he ever joined the Trump campaign, had nothing to do with the Trump campaign. And far from spying with the Russians or colluding with the Russians, General Flynn Flint's problem seemed to stem from him being an agent of Turkey, the Turkish government, not the Russians. And by the way, in Washington, D.C., people like General Flynn take jobs all the time as agents lobbying for foreign governments. Foreign governments hire people who are retired or have held government positions to lobby on their behalf. There's nothing new about that. The only thing new is that the only thing wrong here is that Flynn didn't disclose that. That he had, before he joined the Trump campaign, had been been hired by the Turkish government to lobby on the Turkish government's behalf. Turkey is a problematic player for us in the Middle East, no doubt about it. But they are an ally also. They're an ally, a NATO ally.
That's
so,
right.
Far from proving collusion with the Russians, this seems to be sort of a non sequitur when it comes to that.
Yeah, it's just like you said. I mean, there may be more coming, and there may be. But I don't know how you do too much more than what he did today. I mean, if he says there's no evidence of Americans working with this, I don't know. I mean, unless he's got something else. And my sense is that if he had something else, he would have come out with that first. I don't think he'd do all these minor things, first. I think he would have come out with the big one first. So I don't know. I get the feeling that this may be ending very soon, but I could be wrong, Barry.
It's unusual that you're wrong. I think I've witnessed it one or two times, but I think in this case you may be right. There probably is not a whole lot out there.
No, I don't think so.
But the problem with special prosecutors is that when these special counsels is that you give them a mission and you give them an unlimited budget and tell them to go find something, and generally they don't want to come back saying, "Well, we spent your money and we found nothing." they always want to prove themselves by finding something, and usually it's tangential at best to their original mission. If you remember how Scooter Libby got caught in a perjury trap when they were going after Dick Cheney for a so-called outing of Valerie Plame, the special prosecutor Fitzgerald knew who the perpetrator of the outing, who actually committed the crime they were investigating in the first week. He knew it was a guy named Richard Armitage at the State Department, who had nothing to do with the Republicans, nothing to do with the Bush administration. In fact, was a Democrat. And he was the one who was the source for Robert Novak's article about Valerie Plame. And yet, the special prosecutor continued with his investigation until he was able to catch somebody in the administration, in this case, poor Scooter Libby, in a perjury trap, which is basically going to trip over his words and catch him in an inconsistency and call it perjury.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, that's the problem with these special prosecutors. They often run far afoot of what they were originally intended for.
Right, and I'm sure you remember that Scooter Libby, that whole episode, because I remember one Friday night when Matthews over at MSNBC was on the air saying that he had a source who told him that Dick Cheney, or that Karl Rove was going to be indicted. And they ran with that forever, and it turned out to be false. So, I mean, sometimes the media cannot control itself, which kind of leads me to my next example. This young man in Florida who killed these students. Something came out that he belonged to a white supremacist group, and it happened that a supremacist group took credit, I guess, for the killing or took credit for this young man. So they were running with this story. Now we find out, no, he really wasn't. I mean, so once again, we need some people checking facts before they go out. But I think maybe sometimes, Barry, they're in such a urgency to jump out with a story that they trip, they make mistakes, not honest mistakes. They make mistakes because they want to be the first one out. And when you operate that way, you're going to make a lot of stupid mistakes, Barry.
Yeah, I mean, it's a byproduct, I think, Silvio, of the 24-hour news cycle, where you always got to keep feeding the beast with new tidbits, new flesh, new meat for the viewers. Yeah, there's no doubt that MSNBC and CNN have garnished a much larger share of the market, the viewing market, since Donald Trump was elected, by becoming the voice in the place where the anti-Trump zealots could go and get their bias, the biases affirmed. So they constantly have to come out with hyperbolic stories with little sourcing and very few facts that seem to show progress in this effort to bring down the Trump administration. So, you know, it's that's a big part of it, I think.
Right. And with respect to CNN, I did see a story today that their ratings have really collapsed. MSNBC is doing fine, but CNN is the one that isn't. And I don't know. I don't watch it, but at least it's good to see that people are turning it off. But it seems like there's 3 million people in the country every night, Barry, who want to hear the worst things about Donald Trump. So they're tuning into these networks. Unfortunately for CNN, more are watching MSNBC. I think they're more crazy over there, Barry.
Well, depending on the CNN anchor we're talking about,
yes,
you know, yes, I think MSNBC by and large is crazier. I mean, you can't get much crazier than Chris Cuomo, can you?
No.
At CNN. So, yeah. but Rachel Maddow, Maddow is an interesting character. She presents in very lucid terms the narrative she's trying to sell. Does a very good job of selling it. But she's still selling horse manure. There's just nothing there. She takes very few facts and spins quite a yarn out of them. So she she's earned her audience. I think she is the queen of the anti-Trump jackdaw parliament calling for his blood.
Mm-hmm. That's right. She sure is. And did I lose Barry?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. No, I was
very
just going
to say about the MSNBC.
No. I was just going to say that there's about, you know, I'm roughly about 3.5 million people every night who want to hear this, you know, anti-Trump stuff. It's like, you know, the addiction
right.
They have to go to. And about 3 million go to MSNBC and the other 500,000 go to CNN. MSNBC just does it. They're more hysterical. And so
right.
They're just a better source of that hysterical. You're right, though. It depends on the anchor. But I would have to say that when you just watch some of the clips from MSNBC and you know, they're just nutty. I mean, they're nutty, but they're getting an audience. So I guess as long as they get an audience, they'll keep doing it there.
Well, that's right. I mean, you nailed it right down when you just said that they there's a few million people that are have lost their minds since Trump got elected, and I would argue these same people have been pretty crazy for most of their lives, probably, but certainly for decades. You know, we're talking about the lunatic left, and they've always been unhinged about one thing or another. They hated Reagan. They hated Bush Sr. If you remember, he was portrayed before he became the Bush that everybody liked. He was portrayed in rather Darth Vader-like terms. The so-called October surprise emanated from the Bush administration, the original Bush administration, George H.W. Bush. They hated W with a passion, and Cheney was the new Darth Vader. These people are haters. As that great philosopher Taylor Swift once said, haters are going to hate.
And they're also going to self-destroy, as my mother used to say. And maybe not so so diplomatic terms, but my mother would always say, you can destroy yourself by hating others. And I think
that's
she
true.
Was right about it. That's true. Because you live in such a state of hate where, I mean, and, you know, for example, there's an incident like this one in Florida. It didn't take but 2 minutes for some people to start tweeting, somehow blaming Trump for this. And it's like, you know, you can dislike Trump all you want. I mean, I didn't like President Obama one bit, but I never blamed him for that attack in Connecticut. I mean, I never tweeted, this is Obama's fault that a bunch of children were killed in a school that morning in Connecticut. I forgot the name of that school up there, but you know what I'm talking about, that terrible thing where little kids, 5-6-year-old kids were killed. So it's just, you know, this hatred. I think they're, well, we'll see what happens in November. We'll see what happens in November. The polls are looking better for the Republicans, and that's a good thing. But it's still, yes, a long time to November.
Yes.
Let me, I know one, before we get to the Middle East, I want to ask you for a couple of minutes, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll do a whole segment on the Middle East. But the gun control debate always frustrates me because, for one thing, it makes it all black and white, guns versus no guns, when in fact there's a lot more to it than that. The other thing that frustrates me is that everybody's got to study. You know, you got all these articles and reports comparing the United States to these countries, or, you know, if we only had Australia's gun control laws, this would have never happened, that kind of thing, which is really silly. I mean, that's like saying if a woman had taken this other woman's diet, she would have lost 20 pounds. Well, it doesn't work that way. You know, that's not how it works in life. So it frustrates the heck out of me because it seems when it's all said and done, it's just a lot of hot air, and we're not really protecting the next group of students who could be the target of an attack. And I don't think we're going to protect them, Barry, unless we are willing to put guards at the door. If there had been a guard at this door in Florida, this young man would have been greeted by a guard at the door. And the guard would have said, "Where are you going?" "Well, I want to go in." "Why? You're not even a student. What's in that package you're carrying?" Do you see what I mean? This is, to me, the best defense we have, not, you know, passing more gun laws or whatever. So it just gets very frustrating because we go through this and it's the same, you know, it's like the same song all over again, Barry.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you just said. I think the problem is mental illness. Yeah, I think the problem could be the way that boys are being raised in America today, and many of them being raised without fathers, many of them growing up with a sense of alienation. There is a war against boys going on. The Democrats like to call it a war on women. That's just nonsense. More women are graduating with college degrees than men. Men are having a much tougher time getting into college and graduating. They're being told constantly that they are perpetrators of every, especially white males, of every kind of evil in the world, some of which occurred hundreds of years before they were born. They're being emasculated every turn. And when you take one of these that's mentally unstable and perhaps has been on psychotherapy, psychotropic drugs since he was a child, been medicated since a child, and who knows what that did to his brain chemistry. I'm not talking about this individual, but just in general. There's lots of factors out there we don't really understand. It's not guns. Guns are tools. Just like a book of matches. You can use a book of matches to start a fire that can be an act of arson, or it can light your pilot in your oven so you can cook your dinner. It's how you use the matches, of course, that makes a difference. And guns are the same way. I think there are some common sense gun regulations that perhaps could be implemented, such as 18-year-olds can't buy, you know, assault rifles. At least wait till you're 21 and can vote, or I'm sorry, can drink. Voting is a different issue. I think we should move the voting age back to 21 as well. But in any case, but guns themselves are not the issue, really, and it is a non-starter, and really in many ways a non-sequitur to say that banning guns, as they did in Australia, you know, basically confiscation, would ever work in the United States.
Well, that's it. And this is something that I've tried to explain, Barry, to people from other countries, that there is a tradition of guns in the United States that goes back to the very beginning. There's 300 million guns in the country. So, you know, you're not going to take anybody's guns away in the United States. I agree with you. I think that, you know, bringing the date or taking the date of sale to 21 is a good idea. I also think that, and this was the case clearly in Florida, where information about this young man was not sent to the database. I mean, this young man, how this young man bought a gun is beyond me when you look at his background.
Yes.
I mean, this is a young man. There should have been, you know, this is the young man who should have had all kinds of red flags in his background so that he went, when he goes to buy a gun, the proprietor of the, or the gun dealer can say, "Wait a minute, I cannot sell you a gun. You know, you have a problem." So I just think that was another failing, which leads me to my next point. If people want to write more laws, you know, they want tougher background checks. But if they're not, if the background check, if the database is not up to speed or up to date, what's the point of having even a background check, Barry?
Well, that's right. And there is a thing which has been described by some, like Charles Krauthammer, calls it the do something disease. There's this urge to always do something. As soon as something happens, politicians want to write a new law, pass a new regulation, ban something, because it looks like they're doing something. Mm-hmm. But as the Zen master would say, sometimes doing nothing is the best way of doing something.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I think in many of these cases, we should be, you know, I've always had been of the opinion that I'm willing to put everything on the table, and let's have a frank discussion about everything. But they only want to put guns on the table. They don't want to look at the big picture. Like you said, the family, the breakdown of family. You know, it's interesting to me, and then we'll take a break, but it's fascinating. In 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald, the man who killed President Kennedy, bought his rifle in the mail.
That's right.
So in 1963 in the United States, you could actually buy a rifle in the mail, just the post office. They would bring you a rifle. You know, and people say, well, these things didn't happen back then. No, they didn't. But there were a lot more guns available. People, you know, back then had guns all the time, but these things didn't happen. So I don't know.
No, they didn't. There was a time – I'm still old enough to remember, or I am old enough to remember,
sure.
when every high school, at least every high school I knew of, the ones we went to, my brothers and I, had a gun club. And there were target ranges. You could go out and shoot. And in rural America, which was America, most of America up until World War II, it was not at all uncommon to have kids, boys particularly, bring their hunting gun to the school and leave it in the back of the classroom because – mm-hmm. On the way to school, they'd hunt or way home from school, perhaps they'd hunt varmints, take home for dinner.
Right.
So, but those boys didn't shoot up to school with that gun or
right.
their classmates because there was a whole different value system and a much more intact family back in, say, 1930 or 1830 for that matter than there is today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's exactly right. And that's the part, it's that family conversation, that breakdown of values. That they don't want to talk about. They just want to talk about guns, and
right.
and I think that you know it doesn't make a lot of sense to me if all we talk about is guns and we don't talk about what led this young man to pull the trigger, Barry.
Well, and as far as assault rifles go, a lot of talk about banning the AR-15. Only about 3% of gun violence is done with so-called assault rifles. The vast majority
mm-hmm.
of gun shootings are done with pistols. So it's a knee-jerk reaction that doesn't really match the facts or make much sense if we want to, you know, bring down gun violence.
Right. And then they always say, you know, what's a civilian doing with a military weapon? Well, that's not a military weapon.
It's not. It looks scary to those who don't know better, but the difference between an AR-15 and a M4 assault rifle, which it resembles, is vast. The readily apparent difference being that one fires full auto, meaning that when you pull the trigger, an unlimited amount of bullets come out and don't stop coming out until you release the trigger or you run out of bullets. That's full auto. That's what we often think of as a machine gun. Only military weapons have that, military and perhaps police. The AR-15 doesn't do that. It's what's called semi-automatic, which simply means you pull the trigger when one bullet is released. Pull the trigger again, it fires another round. It only fires around when you pull the trigger, one at a time. It's one step above a bolt-action rifle, which is the most basic hunting rifle in use today, than a pump action. So, you can fire 30 rounds by pulling the trigger 30 times if you have a 30-round magazine. If you have a 10-round magazine, you can fire 10 rounds by pulling the trigger 10 times. But those are mostly cosmetic differences. That's not a military weapon. The AR-15 is meant to look like a military weapon because it's cool and it helps sell the rifle to people who want a rifle that looks like a military weapon, but it's not. It's not the same thing.
Right. Yeah, people would rather have a rifle that looks like a U.S. Army rifle than a Daniel Boone rifle or something like that. I mean, just for
cosmetics. Well, not
me, but
I'm weird that way. I'd rather have the Daniel Boone rifle myself.
No, I understand. But a lot of people, like you say, there are also a lot of collectors. Because I have friends here in the Dallas area who are collectors who just like to have these things for collection purposes. They just like to,
sure.
you know, have them in their home. and just look at them or whatever. I mean, they're not, you know, they're just collectors, Barry.
Can we mention one point before we have to break here, and that's a philosophical
point. Sure, go
ahead,
go ahead.
The First Amendment, I'm sorry, the Second Amendment, which is always under assault during these times, was not put in place to protect hunters' rights. The NRA often approaches it as that, as hunters' rights, the hunters have the right to this, that, and the other. But that's really not the point. The framers of the Constitution did not put the Second Amendment in there to protect hunters' rights to shoot Bambi. They put the Second Amendment in there as a guarantee of our liberty, of our freedom, from tyranny, from our own government particularly. They weren't as concerned, near as concerned, by foreign invasion, as they were of our government deteriorating into some sort of tyranny. So every man would be capable, every citizen would be capable, in a pinch, of picking up his home weapon, which in those days was the exact same weapon the military had, which is, say, a musket or a rifle, a Kentucky long rifle, and stand toe-to-toe as a militia and fight the government if necessary to protect our liberty, like the Minutemen did against the Redcoats at Lexington and Concord. So, you know, if John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were standing here, they might well say, let them have an M16, because they should be able to stand toe-to-toe and fight against the government if necessary with the same weapons the government has.
You're exactly right, and sometimes that Second Amendment story is hard for people to understand who are not knowledgeable of our history. But the bottom line is, for me, is that there's always a vulnerability. There's always a little window. I don't care how many laws you have, you know, how many regulations you have. There's always going to be a window where it's going to be you and a gun. And if that ever happens, I want to be able to defend myself. That's all I can say. You know,
there
I want to be able to defend myself in a situation like that. And in these school shootings, part of the problem here, Barry, and then we'll take a break, but part of the problem is that when you look at the shooter is basically shooting at will. There's nobody to stop him. So he
right.
can just sit there and go through 1-1-1-1-1 and pretty much run out of bullets. There isn't anybody there who can disable him or take him out. And I think that's what contributes to the mass killing. I really do.
You know, I think when you let a wolf or a fox loose in the hen house and the hens have no way to defend
sure.
themselves, or the sheepfold, if you will, then, I mean, you don't want to reduce, I don't believe, we want to reduce the American population to a bunch of sheep, just waiting to be slaughtered, unless the sheepdog comes along. We want basically a nation of free men who can stand on their own feet and defend themselves. In the case of kids in schools, you know, put some guards there. You have them defend
right.
them. The guards to defend them. It makes no sense. We put guards in banks to defend our money because our
sure.
money apparently is more valuable to us than our children.
Well, try to go to the courthouse and you got to go through all kinds of, you know, checkpoints. Try to go to the airport, the same thing. But somebody can walk into a school and the school kids are totally vulnerable. I just don't understand it. If I was a parent and, you know, my kids are not in school anymore, but if I was a parent, that's what I'd be saying at the PTA meeting. Hey, I don't want to hear speeches about gun control. I want a guard in there on that door protecting the school, at least being the first line of defense against somebody like that. Barry, let me take a little break, and then when we come back, we're going to get into quite a bit about what's happening in the Middle East. There's a lot of good, interesting stuff happening. As I mentioned, the Israelis have attacked Syrian and Iranian positions, Russia and Syria. There's a lot to get into with our friend Barry, who's going to update us on all of that. Let me tell you about my good friend Carlos Geddes, who has been playing all around town and getting quite a reputation going from one place to another. We get to play his music on the show, and it's a real treat to do that. Carlos is the guy who you've got in the background when you're having a nice dinner with your wife or your girlfriend or whatever, a little wine and a little romantic night. Well, he's the guy in the background playing the harp and keeping you in a romantic mood. So check his Facebook page. He's got a lot of schedules there as to where he's going to be over the next few weeks. Make sure you go to one of his places. I tell you, I loved it. You know, we loved it. It was a really neat idea to spend the night, nice romantic music, and that wonderful music in the background. Does that sound romantic to you, Barry? A nice dinner with your special one and a little wine, a nice meal, and a nice little background music?
It sounds nice to me. You know, it's a little wine, a loaf of bread, a bit of cheese, and the, was that what Omar Khayyam said? Because I think he was talking about a boy. So,
that's right.
But anyway, yeah, that sounds very romantic.
It sure does.
And I am romantic just like you are.
Yes, of course. I think all, you know, right-wingers tend to be more romantic. I don't know. Maybe we're more traditional. Let's just put it that way. One quick thing I wanted to say before we get to the Middle East. Tomorrow, since we're doing a show today, I wanted to mention it. Tomorrow, Jim Brown is 82. Now, you and I are old enough to remember him, the great running back with the Cleveland Browns. What an amazing player he was. He didn't play a whole, I think he played 10 years, but he was maybe the best runner ever. What do you think?
I think he's amazing. He certainly would own every record if he had played a full career because he retired long before he was injured. The most amazing thing about Jim Brown is he played with almost no pads on. You know, he went out there and took a lick in every single game, got up, and by the way, delivered as many licks as he got. Then went on, of course, to a stellar career in film as one of the stars of the early late 60s black exploitation movies. He didn't do Shaft, but it was the same genre as Shaft. But he was quite a good actor too.
Right. And the other day I was flipping channels and I see him with Raquel Welch. In a movie,
yes, 100 Rifles.
Yeah, that's right. Movie from the early 70s, I guess, or whatever. So you're right. Well, let's talk about the Middle East. Some really amazing things happening in the Middle East. I'll let you take whichever one of the topics, whichever one you want to go with first, Barry.
Well, let's start with the madhouse that has become Syria in the last 8 days. Syria has become a miniature little World War III in a very low level sort of way. You have Turkey, Israel, Syria, Free Syrian Forces, the United States, and Iran, plus independent players like Hezbollah, and then Russian mercenaries, all clashing at various incidents in Syria and near the Israeli border with Syria. You had, in one incident, a Iranian drone, by the way, Iran, which helped along with Russia to keep Assad in power, has been stationing air assets, air defense systems, and probably troops near the Israeli border on the Golan Heights, or near the Golan Heights. And they flew a drone into Israeli airspace. Israel responded by sending F-16s in to destroy it. One of those F-16s was then shot down by a Syrian or Iranian air defense battery, which shouldn't probably happen because the Israeli plane was pretty sophisticated, had a lot of upgrades. Israel's looking into why that happened and what went wrong. But they got the last laugh because they sent a massive retaliation airstrike against Iranian and Syrian air defense systems that shot down the plane and other ones that could, in the future shoot down the planes and just bomb the heck out of them. So Israel is very active and a bit nervous that Hezbollah or Iran, even worse, will put themselves in a position to start firing rockets again into northern Israel. So that's one element that happened in the last 8 days. And then during that same period, the Turks drove into a minor league offensive into Kurdistan, in the Kurdish region, and were threatening to push even deeper when America sent several of our generals into the threatened area to talk with the Kurds and send the message to Erdogan in Turkey that these guys are buddies and we're not going to stand by unless you just run right over them. So the Turks slowed down, backed off a bit. We'll see what happens in the future. But the most interesting thing of all was right on the Euphrates River, on the eastern side, there was an American Special Forces team or two that were training Syrian Free Independent Forces Free Syrian Army, which are anti-Assad forces. And that river, the Euphrates, has been a demarcation line between pro-Assad and anti-Assad forces. And we had an understanding with the Russians who were propping up Putin, propping up Assad. We had an understanding that that was the line that won't be crossed. That you'll stay on one side of the Euphrates and we'll stay on the other. This, by the way, is not too far from Raqqa, the former capital of ISIS, which we'd just helped liberate. And last week, about 500, about a battalion element of pro-Assad forces, pro-Assad militia, spearheaded by Russian mercenaries, which aren't really Russian mercenaries at all. They've been called that to give Russia some denial. More likely, they're Russian, regular Russian ground forces, probably Spetsnaz, acting as advisors, much like our special forces were on the other side of the river. They crossed the river, this battalion element, to attack that camp. They even had tanks involved in the attack, artillery, mortars, tanks, about 500 ground fighters. It's a very serious attack that potentially could have overrun the camp and killed however many special forces guys we had there. Now, a special forces A-team, Operational Detachment Alpha, of which I was once a member, it consists of 12 guys. So there's not a whole lot of American guys there, but they are a huge force multiplier. And this was illustrated by the fact they were able to call in instantly every air asset in the theater and planes, including AC-130 gunships, which I'll describe in just a moment for your audience, F-18 Hornets and other air assets came in and pounded the snot out of this attacking battalion, killing about one-fifth of it, at least. Many Russian mercenaries were killed, and at least one tank was knocked down before they scuttled back across the river and went back into hiding. An AC-130 gunship is the modern equivalent of what used to be called the Spectre gunship, or the Spooky, in Vietnam. It is a C-130 that has been tricked out with mini guns in the windows that fire about 3,000 rounds per minute. They can be anything from 7.62 to 30 Mike, 30 millimeter cannon, these Gatling guns. It also has a howitzer, a 105 howitzer in the tailgate. Normally, these tailgates drop down to let cargo off. In this case, it drops down and the cannon can fire out the back of the plane. And they can do this with pretty much pinpoint precision. So if you went to close air support, there's only one thing better, and that's an A-10 Thunderbolt, which apparently we're not on station. But AC-130, for instance, if that had been in Benghazi, those guys might still be alive today. Or in Somalia, that matter, when Black Hawk Down when went down. Because that's a lot of firepower, a lot of kick-ass.
Yeah, I think the Israelis have those, don't they? The gunships, they call them?
I don't think they have AC-130s, no? Sylvia. I think they use F-16s for air assault and sometimes helicopters.
No, okay. I just remember one time, 10 or 15 years ago, the Israelis flew in with what they call a gunship and hit quite a few targets below. But it may have been something completely different. It just, you know, I thought it was the same thing. But when you look at all these events, and I think you were also going to talk about the Russians in Syria. I think you did that already, right?
I'm talking about Hamas and ISIS in war with each other in the Sinai, too.
Yeah, let's get into that. Go ahead and tell us about that, because I've got a couple of general questions after. So go ahead and tell me about ISIS.
Well, I mean, in the final piece of this really unstable puzzle is a civil war going on between Islamic extremists down in the Sinai. The Sinai was given over to Egypt as part of the Camp David Accords way back when. It had been occupied by Israel after the Six-Day War. It was turned back over to Egypt. Today it is the scene of an insurgency being perpetrated by both the Muslim Brotherhood against the Egyptian government and by ISIS. There are elements that they're claim allegiance to ISIS. And up until now, Hamas was clandestinely cooperating out of the Gaza Strip with ISIS down south in the Sinai against the government of al-Sisi, President al-Sisi of Egypt. Who overthrew the Muslim Brotherhood, as you remember, a couple years back. and has been making overtures to both Israel and the United States, and of course Jordan, trying to put together some sort of a coalition against ISIS. But they've been fighting a war against ISIS and up until now Hamas, to a lesser extent, in the Sinai. But Hamas now is trying to achieve some sort of rapprochement with Egypt, and they've cut off their ties with ISIS, and that's led to ISIS starting to execute Hamas members. And Hamas, in turn, rounding up ISIS members in Gaza. So blood has been shed. ISIS doesn't brook any opposition. There's only room for one radical zealot on that block, and ISIS wants to be it. Keep in mind, ISIS doesn't recognize any Islamic or Muslim government, any Arab government, except themselves. They believe themselves to be a caliphate representing Islam. And what caliphate means is a caliph is the successor of Muhammad. So he is the one true government whose authority descends from the Prophet Muhammad himself. So their natural enemy is going to be every other Arab government, as well as all infidels, and of course Jews, like the Israelis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just going to say, another exciting week over in the Middle East, huh? Another.
Yes.
Yeah.
Never a dull moment over there.
No, never a dull moment over there. But, of course, I think you probably anticipate the question I'm going to ask you. Where do we fit in? And what can we do? Or maybe it's better for us to stay out and let these events happen. So, I mean, where do we fit in? I know we were involved in some of the fighting, but where do we fit in, and what should we do?
All right. Well, it's been said by statesmen that nations don't have friends, that they have merely interests. I'm not sure that's completely true. I think Israel is a friend, just as Britain is, and Australia, and to some extent Canada. You know, we have friends, but we also have interests, and it's generally in our interest to support our friends. Because you only get so many of those. And when you betray them, the next guy that you ask to join your side in some conflict is going to think twice because you didn't treat your last friends very well. So where's that leading to? Well, the Kurds have been fighting alongside us and really were the most effective element in the Free Syrian forces fighting against ISIS in the recent conflict that destroyed most of that caliphate in Syria. And as well as Iraq. And the Kurds want their own state. There are Kurdish enclaves in Turkey, there are Kurdish communities in northern Syria, northern Iraq, and even in the edge of Iran. And so none of those countries I just named want there to be an independent Kurdistan, because it would take pieces out of their country. And the Kurdish elements in their country would break away. But it's in our best interest, I think, to support our friends, in this case, the Kurds, because that's how you maintain friends and gain new friends in the future. I don't know if we ever promised the Kurds their own country, but if they end up fighting for it, I think we should stand with them and make sure they get it. That's just my opinion. Beyond that, Israel is our truest friend in the Middle East. It is the only successful Western democracy in the Middle East. And deserves and always has in the past had our support. And right now, they're not getting a lot of help from us, other than lip service. With these clashes between them and Iran, for instance, on their northern border, we should take note of this and do everything we can to make Iran and the rest of the world understand, including the Russians, by the way, because the Russians lost a plane in Syria this week as well. They had one of their own planes shot down, as well as those Russian mercenaries killed. You might see a situation where Putin decides to flex his muscles and try to shoot down an Israeli plane or two. So, you know, if that happens, we have to stand firm with Israel and make sure that Turkey, who is tacitly an ally, a NATO ally, and Putin and Iran and any other power that threatens Israel has to understand that we stand side by side with no daylight between us, whatever that means.
Do you think that that was communicated to Putin? I mean, I'm not that you would know, but I mean, do you think that was communicated to Putin? That this, I mean, much the same way, for example, that President Reagan communicated to Argentina back in 1982. I mean, if you remember the Falkland Wars, I'm sure you do. Back then, you know, Vice President Bush took two trips down to Argentina, trying to figure out some way of getting the government of Argentina not to fight. But at the last moment, as I understand, Argentina was told, look, if you go to war with Britain, we're with him. And that's what happened. So do you think that a message like that could be sent to Putin saying, hey, if you cross the line, we're with him? That would be interesting.
That's necessary. I think it's necessary because when America backs off and gives the tacit green light to aggressors that we're not going to interfere, that sort of message led to the First Korean War in 1950 when North Korea was given the impression by Harry Truman that South Korea was not under the American umbrella of protection. It was miscommunicated to North Korea and to Stalin that we were not going to protect South Korea. And, in fact, we decided we had to. The same thing happened in Kuwait when April Gillespie, then an ambassador to Iraq, failed to tell in stern enough words, stern enough language, to fail to tell Saddam Hussein that we would defend Kuwait if necessary. And he was given the impression that he had a free hand to attack Kuwait. So I think it'd be if we want to prevent conflict, a good thing to do up front is let the bad guys know that if they do X, it's going to lead to Z. That you do X, you know, we're going to do Y and Z. So, yes, answer to your question. We should let Putin and Iran and anyone else know that if it comes to open hostilities against Israel, we stand with Israel.
Let me ask you one last question. About that, I mean, let's assume that there is a conflict. How bad could it get? I mean, a conflict involving Iran, Russia, the United States, and Israel. I mean, I guess that could be a pretty big war.
I mean, it's unlikely to. It's unlikely that it would go beyond what you're seeing now writ large, which is, say, rockets being exchanged, planes occasionally attacking air defense systems or being shot down by air defense systems. I doubt you're going to see worst case scenario, which is that attack on the special forces base by that battalion element. Imagine that times 100 against the northern Israel with Iran and Syria backed by Russia and Hezbollah coming out of Lebanon attacking northern Israel. To what purpose? The only purpose would be to crush Israeli military and possibly annihilate Israel. That's the worst case scenario. And it could also be backed up by nuclear or other kinds of chemical, you know, weapons of mass destruction. Assad used chemical weapons just last week against anti-Assad forces. So you could see chemical attacks being made against Israel. That's the worst case scenario. I don't think that's going to happen. I think as long as Israel is the strongest power in that region, and it is, and as long as we're willing to back them up, and we should, it won't get out of hand. But Putin, on the other hand, would like to establish a Pax, you know, Russia, if you will, a Russian peace in the Middle East under his terms, where he props up Assad and gets naval base, has a naval base at Latakia on the coast, and air base there, and you can support or not support whoever he wishes, much like the Soviets had way back when in the 60s with Nasser in Egypt. So he would like that. Putin would like that, and this threatens him as much as it threatens us. If Israel attacks Assad in force, it does nothing but put Putin in a very difficult position, an unenviable position of having to decide to support Assad against Israel directly with Russian planes and Russian air defense assets. And I'm not sure he wants to do that.
Right. I don't know. I kind of get the feeling that if you're a foreign country today with President Trump and Secretary of Defense Mathis, I kind of get the feeling that you know exactly what the consequences will be. That's the one thing I got to give Secretary of Defense Mattis and President Trump. They make it very clear. There's no gray area with those two guys, Barry.
Well, you know, one thing that made Ronald Reagan so successful as a foreign policy president was that our enemies weren't quite certain what he would do. They weren't quite certain how far he would take things. And as opposed to, say, Jimmy Carter or Obama, who announced before anything else what they wouldn't do. They were always quick to say, we're not going to use military force. They're quick to say, I'm not going to go into here, I'm not going to go into there, I'm not going to use military force. They took things off the table long before it ever came to bargaining. And nobody thought Obama would ever use, you know, force, or Jimmy Carter for that matter. But with Reagan, there was always that uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And that's good. A little strategic uncertainty is keeps your enemies on their toes and makes them fear you. And sometimes fear is a potent thing. And I think
Absolutely.
Trump is in that same category as Reagan.
Yeah, and it's the old story. I think it was Richard Nixon, or when Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon were talking, and I'm paraphrasing, but when they were talking, and basically Richard Nixon said, I want to be unpredictable, basically, for them, basically the Russians or the Soviets. He said, you know, you be the diplomatic guy, and I'll be the, you know, the unpredictable guy. And sometimes you have to keep the other guy wondering, gee, if I do this, what's his response going to be? And I think you're exactly right with Reagan. Everybody knew that you didn't mess with Reagan. I would argue the same with George W. Bush. I mean, I know he's been, you know, not as popular, I guess, as with others. But I thought he was pretty definite in what he said and did, Barry.
Well, people forget that we were able to disarm Gaddafi and turn that tiger into a pussycat. Just by showing resolve in Iraq. You know, one of the good unintended consequences of Iraq was that Gaddafi said, I don't want any of that. I just saw what happened to Saddam Hussein. I don't want that happening to me.
Right.
And he feared Bush, and he gave up his weapons of mass destruction. And unfortunately, the downside was when Obama became president and Hillary became Secretary of Defense, State, they then attacked Gaddafi, and they overthrew him, which was a breach of the tacit agreement. If he gave up his weapons of mass destruction and was allowed to join the community of nations, he'd be left alone.
Right,
so,
and then Libya after that was a mess.
It is a mess, and I'm sure Kim in North Korea is looking at that and saying, I see what happens when I give up my weapons of mass destruction. I have no leverage left, and I'll end up like Gaddafi, you know, beaten to death by a mob.
That's right, and that's exactly how he would end up. Well, Barry, you're just too interesting. I don't know what to say. You're just too interesting of a guy here to chat with. But unfortunately, I got to deal with the clock. But I want to thank you, as always, for your time. And whenever you want to do this, just let me know. And we'll schedule one, because I find this as interesting as any. I mean, to me, this is really fascinating. And listening to you and the way you put it all together, it's just great. So whenever you want to do it, just let me know.
It'll be soon, sooner than later, my friend.
I think so. I hope so, because, as I say, I enjoy it a great deal. Have a great weekend. I guess President's Day coming up Monday. And have a great weekend. We'll hopefully chat very soon, because I really love doing these shows with you.
Have a good night.
Thank you so much. Our good friend Barry Jacobson, we have a link to his website on the show information. And it's just absolutely wonderful to chat with him and get that national security foreign policy perspective that we need to get from time to time. We also talked a little bit about gun control in the first part of the show, if you have a chance to go back and hear that part again. Have a wonderful Friday evening. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. And we'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.